Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Christopher Hale, an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Alabama, where I'd like to send my son for college. Roll Tide. The University of Alabama is in Tuscaloosa, which is the home of two, not just one, but two Waffle Houses on McFarland Boulevard, and I may have visited them both. Chris earned his PhD at Arizona State University in 2013 by writing a dissertation that earned the American Political Science Association's Aaron Wildowski Award for Best Dissertation in Religion and Politics a year later. Whew, seriously, folks, you academics got to come up with shorter titles for these awards. It's getting to me. All right. While cutting his scholarly teeth on Mexican politics, Professor Hale is actually quite broad in his interest and has performed some interesting experimental work on religion and generosity in Europe with another former guest on our show, Carolyn Warner. He has published in numerous scholarly outlets, such as Comparative Politics and Nations and Nationalism, and is polishing up two book manuscripts tentatively entitled Generating Generosity, Beliefs, Institutions, and Public Goods Provision in Catholicism and Islam, and Religion and Political Activism, Decentralized Catholic Governance and Collective Action in Mexico. It is that latter topic that shall be the focus of our discussion today. It should also be noted that Chris was a participant in a graduate student workshop sponsored by Chapman University's Institute for the Study of Religion, Economics, and Society, where he then later served as a postdoctoral fellow. For those of you who are graduate students or recently minted PhDs, IRIS offers a lot of opportunities to further your research, including workshops that involve your fuzzy little host of Research on Religion. You can find links to that IRIS fellowship, as well as to Chris's biography and some of his writings, on our website, so please check it out. Chris, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony, for having me. I'm excited to talk to you today.
Yeah, lots of good stuff to talk about here today, but I want to first give you the chance to tout your experience over at the Institute for the Study of Religion, Economics, and Society at Chapman, because they've been pushing people to come and explore all their opportunities there. So was it a good experience, and what do postdocs do when they're down there?
Yeah, it was a terrific experience, and sort of, so postdocs can tend to vary from position to position, but my experience with my postdoc, it was terrific because my sole responsibility was basically to write and to do research. So there were no teaching responsibilities associated with it whatsoever. Their expectation and what they've designed that postdoc to be is basically a platform for you to launch your career. And from that perspective, it was extremely helpful. I got a ton of work done on both the project that you had mentioned I'm working on with Carolyn and on my own sort of book project. And so just the time and the resources that were granted by the postdoc were really, really excellent. And I really appreciate it. And I also have to note that Larry Iannacone, who's the director of the Institute, really made sort of a personal mission out of making sure that my wife and I were settled well into Southern California. They took very good care of us, and it was, I would strongly recommend that for anybody who's interested in sort of the religious economy school. And it's just a great place, you know, once you finish your PhD, that's sort of a tough, it's sort of a tough position in life, right, to sort of finish your PhD and sort of be between that and a tenure-track position. And it's just a great place to land while you're looking for that tenure-track job.
You didn't mention anything about the waffle restaurant right down the street.
And there is a terrific waffle place right there at Chapman University that does a great fried chicken and waffles.
Yes, it's called Bruxy's. I'm trying to get a sponsorship for research on religion from them because they have some of the best waffles there, and I love going down there every year and just dining at that restaurant. And all the scholarship is great too. So, folks, if folks, if you are interested in IRIS and fellowships and workshops, or if you have students that are interested in that, please check out our website and go over there. Let's move down to Mexico now, though, which is where you focused your dissertation research and with Great Expectations forthcoming, your book, right? So that'll be coming out soon, we hope. Tell us a little bit about how you came to study religion in Mexico. What motivated your interest here, and how did you generate a research question or topic?
Yeah, that was there was a lot that sort of brought me to that. I would say, you know, my interest in religion specifically, I would say I owe that to my parents. I grew up in a very, very religious household, and so I've always been sort of impressed by religion's ability to get people moving and to get people active and to get people out and doing something. And so I would say that really prompts sort of my interest in religion, and that I would say was sort of further encouraged by a class I took on in religion and politics with Carolyn Warner at Arizona State University. That was where I was first introduced to the religious economy school, and I really had an affinity with that point of view of looking at, you know, how religion impacts political outcomes. And so I would say that really sort of framed how I was, why I was interested in looking at religion. So as I was going into my dissertation, I knew I was sort of interested in doing something in religion and politics. I would say that my interest in Latin America comes very much from my wife, who I met more than 10 years ago. It's hard to believe, but we took, when we were first dating, we took a trip together to Guatemala, which is where she's from, and I was, you know, I really fell in love with Guatemala. It's just an incredible country, and it's a beautiful country, and I would strongly encourage anybody to travel there and go see it, because there's a lot to go do and see, but I became fascinated by sort of the indigenous populations that reside in Guatemala, and, you know, they have this very rich cultural tradition. But at the same time, they're very disenfranchised from broader Guatemalan society, right? They don't have the same types of economic opportunities. You know, their levels of political engagement tend to be much lower than the mestizo population of the country. And I became very fascinated by this, you know, sort of the relationship between mestizo and the indigenous populations of Guatemala. And sort of as I began to look into it more, I had found that the Catholic Church had actually played a strong role in advocating on behalf of these populations and sort of giving them, helping them to find a voice for themselves in Guatemalan society. And there's sort of an ugly history there, but you know, they were able to sort of coalesce politically and make demands on the Guatemalan political system. And so I really became interested in that. And then, so I sort of put that on the back burner. I wasn't sort of originally thinking, well, this is what I want to sort of do with my dissertation topic. And then as I sort of, one of the things I recommend for graduate students is that they need to be thinking sort of early and often about what it is that they want to do for their dissertation topic. I mean, day one of graduate school, I don't think is necessarily too early to be thinking about that. And the reason why I tell them that is because that was absolutely not what I did, right? I finished comps, and then I really had no idea what I wanted to write my dissertation about. And it was sort of a stressful time, right? And so, you know, they tell you to write about what you know. And so I was like, okay, so I sort of know about religion. I sort of know about, you know, Latin America. I just started reading. I started reading like crazy began to focus on Mexico for a variety of reasons. Mexico is it's a very large country, right? There's a lot of data. The Mexican government is very good at collecting data across the country, so I knew I had access to statistical data with Mexico, and Mexico has a very, you know, it's demographically is very similar to Guatemala in some ways, which is what had been sort of stoked my interest in the region, in the sense that in the south of Mexico you have this very large indigenous population that also has been economically disenfranchised and politically disenfranchised, and so I really began to sort of gravitate interest towards the south of Mexico. And so I would just fire off these little half-page sort of ideas about what my dissertation might be potentially to Carolyn Warner, who would sort of shoot them down, right, which was helpful, right, because she just sort of saved me from going on the wrong track of my dissertation. But so we went through this process where I was trying to figure out what it was I was going to be doing and sort of put two and two together. And I started to notice this pattern throughout Latin America that that the Catholic Church had been involved in prompting political organization, political participation throughout the region. And it was where, you know, you had this progressive Catholicism. It was where the Catholic Church was advocating liberation theology. It was advocating for the participation of the citizens, right, that there seemed to be some kind of connection there between the Catholic Church and prompting political participation across the region. And I was also reading stuff by, you know, Michael Hector, who was also on my dissertation committee, Eleanor Ostrom, these really micro-level accounts about how it is that you get collective action. And specifically, you know, Carolyn Warner had written some stuff sort of looking at the impact of the hierarchical organization of religious institutions and their impact on political outcomes. I sort of gravitated towards that, and then I stumbled on the work of Eleanor Ostrom, which really sort of provides this micro-level sort of account, right, for how institutional decentralization might prompt political organization. And that seemed like it was sort of jiving well with what I was reading in Latin America. And when I finally had sort of stumbled upon this, I sort of knew I had it, right? So I sort of just realized institutional decentralization by religious organizations leads to heightened collective action outcomes. And so once I had that, I didn't even send sort of a little half-page thing to Carolyn Warner to review. I went ahead and wrote out the entire perspective because I knew I had it. And I'd say that was sort of the genesis of the project.
Yeah, law, reading in a lot of different areas can actually spur a lot of different ideas there. So very cool. So your topic, you kind of hinted at it to begin with, decentralization and activism. But do you have a specific question that you really targeted in your dissertation?
Yeah, so I started, as I mentioned, I was looking at southern Mexico. And so I started to look at, I was sort of intrigued by this sort of differences in political outcomes between two Mexican states, Chiapas and Yucatan. And what's interesting about these two states in Mexico is that they're very similar in a lot of different ways. They're both very, very poor. They're both heavily indigenous. They're both located at what traditionally has been sort of the margin of Mexican national politics. And despite these similarities, they vary substantially in their levels of collective action and political participation. Chiapas is been characterized by very, very high levels of political activism, most famously by the Zapatista uprising in 1994. But Chiapas is also characterized by this very, very large and rich array of civic organizations. There's a lot of political activity that's going on in Chiapas. If you look at Yucatan, on the other hand, you see very, very little political activism. There's little civic engagement at all. You see very, very few civic organizations. And despite its many similarities, Chiapas, and actually, despite sort of having several advantages on Chiapas that maybe we can talk about, we don't see political activism arise in Yucatan at all, right? And so then sort of taking a broader perspective, you know, we see that religious organizations, you know, they're often touted as these mobilizers of political participation and political activism. To borrow a phrase from Paul Chupe, who's the editor of Politics and Religion, they're seen as these basically vending machines for political participation, right? You drop a quarter into a religious organization and political participation comes out of it, right? And one of the things that I think that a lot of the sort of traditional literature that's looked at this hasn't necessarily asked the question of why it is that religious organizations facilitate secular participation in some settings but not in others, right? Because, I mean, if you look at, so we have the sort of the instructive case of Chiapas and Yucatan, right, where apparently the Catholic Church seems to have mobilized political participation in Chiapas, but the Catholic Church didn't do anything in Yucatan, right? So there seems to be some kind of variation that's not being explained there. And so we can take a broader perspective. You know, certainly we can look at the United States. We can look at the influence of the African American Church on political activism. We can look at the influence of Islam throughout the Arab world, prompting political participation throughout the Arab world. But, you know, we also have a lot of situations where religion hasn't seemed to prompt political participation. I mean, Karl Marx very famously described religion as the opiate of the masses, right? And the Catholic Church has traditionally been sort of seen as being, you know, inhibiting civic engagement and civic participation. And so there's this interesting question of why it is that religious organizations facilitate secular political participation and why we see that variation in that role.
Okay, so let's go ahead and explore that. Yucatan, not much participation. Chiapas a lot, but you then generalize this statistically. So for folks that don't know much about Mexican political history or religious history, if you could set the table for us, perhaps go back maybe a half century, a century to find out what the religious landscape looks like, what the political landscape looks like, and what all these folks are getting politically active about. Do they have any, you know, complaints that they want to be voicing, or what's going on there?
Yeah, so I think, you know, Mexico is sort of fascinating. If you think about, you know, maybe if we start with the religious sort of landscape, I guess, you know, we're talking about what the religious economy school, maybe all the way up to the 1950s, would have described as sort of a monopolistic religious economy, right? The Catholic Church really holds something of a stranglehold on sort of religious life, right? That changes. Let me put it this way. Even to this day, I think something that in the neighborhood of about 80% of the population in Mexico adheres to Roman Catholicism. But there have been several pockets in Mexico that have become sort of the forefront of Protestant advance. So since about the 1960s and 1970s, particularly in southern Mexico, we see that Protestant denominations are becoming very, very influential in Mexican society to the extent that, particularly amongst the indigenous populations, that we see very, very large proportions of some of these communities have become Protestant. And this is very concerning for the Catholic Church, who, you know, I think the explanation of the religious economy school would be that, you know, the Catholic Church as a lazy monopolistic supplier, right, had sort of failed to adequately respond to the needs and demands of its parishioners, and this created an opening for Protestants really to sort of come in and make a lot of, you know, to evangelize effectively across the region. And so when we look at sort of the religious landscape of Mexico, we see, you know, what is still in a lot of ways a very dominant Catholic Church, but which is now encountering this encroaching challenge of Protestant competition, right? It's very, very concerned about that. That has an important interplay, I think, with the political landscape in Mexico, which is, you know, for between sort of 1930 and year 2000, we get 70 years, basically, of single-party rule by the pre-political party, you know, this very dominant corporatist type of political party that really dominates Mexican politics. And it's not until, and for the most part, I think Mexicans are sort of fairly happy with pre-rule until we get to about, you know, some cracks starting in the 1970s, but particularly when we get to the 1980s, we get the debt crisis in Latin America. The pre doesn't seem to be able to respond to that particularly effectively.
I got to stop you here a minute. You're saying yeah. Pre, and I don't think many people might know what that is. That's the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or Partido Revolucionario. You pronounce it. You're better at Spanish.
Partido Revolucionario Institucional, which is the Institutional Revolutionary Party, right, as you're saying.
Yeah, which is kind of funny to have an institutional revolution.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And sort of a dark history in the Mexican Revolution, right? Lots of political assassinations, a lot of violence, and literally trying to institutionalize the goals of the revolution, right? And a lot of people would argue not particularly successfully, but bringing much needed stability to Mexican politics, sort of at the end of the 1920s, the beginning of the 1930s, but yeah, then becoming sort of a political monster, right? So it starts to fail in the 1980s. There are a variety of reasons for that. Mexico's putting, you know, we see massive levels of state spending in the 1970s that aren't really sustainable for a variety of reasons. And the edifice really starts to fall apart in the 1980s. It can't hold the system together anymore. And that creates an important political opening in the 1980s where opposition parties have a legitimate challenge to what had been the dominant political party. And there are some electoral opportunities there as well. And so the period that I'm studying, right, comes at this sort of, you know, I'm looking basically about the antecedents for this political opening really starting about the 1960s through the present day. And that's sort of the context that I'm working in.
Okay. All right. So there's the political. And in terms of the protests down in the southern area of Mexico where you're primarily doing your field work, Yucatan, Chiapas, what gripes would they have? It seems wonderful. It's a tropical place. It's warm. You know, what would they have to complain about?
Yeah, it's interesting that you put it that way too, because one of the questions I was asking people in Chiapas and Yucatan was, I mean, why the protests or in Yucatan, why the lack of protests? And one of the respondents in Yucatan told me, well, because this is paradise. What would they have to protest about? I don't find that to be a particularly compelling rationale, right? But yeah, that he sort of made this sort of the same type of statement. And Really, I think there are very serious things to potentially protest about in both Chiapas and Yucatan. You know, in addition to the indigenous populations of the region being very marginalized, we also get the, throughout Chiapas and Yucatan both, we get the breakdown of sort of corporatist systems of government. So this is where the Mexican federal government would spend massively on basically industry that was completely defunct, right? That wasn't sort of functioning particularly effectively. And so in Yucatan in particular, there was a natural fiber that the Mexican government was basically propping up because it needed the vote, it needed people in, you know, it needed political support in Yucatan, and that's why it was doing it. And when we get these economic reforms in the 1980s, it's not capable of propping up that industry anymore. We're talking about the major supplier of jobs to the people of the region. And so when that system sort of collapses, a lot of people lose their jobs. There's a great deal of popular discontent, right? But in Yucatan, that doesn't manifest itself in any way in any kind of political protest. Whereas in Chiapas, we get similar types of, you know, we get economic, huge economic disparities in Chiapas. There are very, very poor individuals in Chiapas. It ranks amongst the bottom of Mexican states in a variety of, you know, health measures, income measures. And in Chiapas, we do see movements, right? And so, to answer your question about sort of what it is that people would have to protest about it in southern Mexico, I would say it really begins to coalesce around this issue of social justice, right? I mean, that becomes sort of a key concern in the south of Mexico. I would say concurrently with that, across Mexico generally, right, particularly in the north, there's this also real interest in the idea of electoral reform and sort of cleaning up the political system. So there's quite a bit to protest in Mexico at this time.
Okay. So now we have some interesting variation, and every social scientist loves variation. So explain this now. Why would religion become a catalyst for protest or a cause for protest? And what are some of the previous ideas, and what's your explanation?
Yeah, so as I've sort of alluded to, there's all kinds of literature that says that religion is essentially this vending machine of political participation, right? This is sort of stylistically, right? We can very broadly think about, I think, two strands of literature that have begun to go a little bit deeper into trying to express why it is that religion does that, the conditions under which we might expect religion to do that. And I think we can sort of broadly conceive of these as being essentially ideas versus interests. And I would say that people who argue for ideas suggest that where we have a particular type of political theology that demands some kind of engagement with the state, that explains why we see sort of heightened levels of political participation. And I think as this would apply specifically to Mexico and Latin America, and this is, of course, based on Daniel Philpott has written somewhat extensively about this, that where we have liberation theology, right, and not just Philpott, but a lot of people have written about liberation theology. You know, liberation theology is this movement within the Catholic Church that basically suggests that the church needs to express a preferential option for the poor, right? It needs to advocate on behalf of the poor, and it needs to enable poor communities to effectively demand their own political rights. And so that makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, if you've got a particular political theology that demands this type of engagement with the political system, it would seem natural to assume that where this becomes prevalent, right, that is going to encourage individuals to become politically engaged. I think there's the other sort of broad way that we can characterize the literature looks at interests, and this is, and particularly the political economy school, and Tony, obviously your own work has tended to emphasize the interests of religious elites in their efforts to strengthen the institutional position of their religion as an institution, and so they tend to be motivated by interests, and particularly I think, you know, one of the really dominant frameworks coming out of this is that where we see high levels of religious competition, that this is going to inspire, you know, is particularly in the context of Mexico and the Catholic Church, what had been a previously lazy monopolistic supplier is now going to have to make, you know, and which has been sort of very clearly associated with the ruling governmental regime, is now going to have to make a credible commitment to the people. It's going to have to show them that it really stands for their values, and it's going to have to, it basically, when we get Protestant competition like we've seen in southern Mexico, that prompts the Catholic Church, and it doesn't want to lose its adherence. And so now it has to visibly demonstrate to its people, right, that it's with the people. It has to give them the capacity to stand up to the Mexican government and to forcefully advocate for their own rights.
Yeah, there was a great book written about that.
Yes, Guillermo Trejo, who wrote specifically looking at the situation in southern Mexico. Excellent book. And 2012 through Cambridge University Press, I believe. So that is very much the argument that he's making.
There was another great book written about that too.
Yes, Rhetoric Under Caesar.
Thank you. See, I had to prompt you on this because now I can tag this on the website so people can visit the link.
Yes. Also excellent book. Applying that to Argentina and Chile, obviously.
Okay.
Explaining variation. Yeah.
So
terrific book.
I know Trejo gets all the credit, but you know his book was very good. We'll post a link to his book there as well. But that Rendering Unto Caesar by your fuzzy little host here, also, yeah.
And I would say your work was certainly foundational.
Foundational.
Foundational
like wet cement boots on people. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
All right, I had to get you to mention that. I was like, we're already about 25 minutes in, and he hasn't mentioned my name. I'm like starting to cry here.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, I did start that discussion with you've written extensively about this.
Okay, all right, okay. Carry on. So we got these two competing things: ideas and interests. What are you finding?
I've been motivated, I think, by this sort of micro level work on collective action, right? And so the way that I see it is I think that there's a lot to both the ideology and the religious competition style of arguments. But based on a collective action class I took with Michael Hector, I was and particularly motivated by Michael's work, and also there's a really good book called The Rebel's Dilemma by Mark Irving Leekbach, who basically sort of fleshes out the micro-level dynamics of why we get rebel movements, and not just rebel movements, but what he also calls, I believe, political protest movements, and breaks it down as far as the micro-level dynamics of the prisoner's dilemma, right? I mean, just really this sort of econometric sort of framework of looking at why it is that we get collective action. And so I think that the ideological and the interest-based perspectives on religion and political engagement, they helpfully point us to the conditions under which religious elites might be interested in using their religious organization politically or allowing it to be used politically. But what I think is still not quite explained with that perspective is what helps individuals at the local level actually overcome the free rider problem, which was famously sort of expressed, I think probably most famously expressed by Mansur Olson, who said that when you have something like political activism, which is the benefits of political activism we can conceptualize as being a public good. And so this is like, so when individuals go out in the streets to protest, the benefits of that protest, let's say it's regime change, right? The benefits of that accrue to everyone who wanted to see regime change, right? Whether or not they went out to the streets to protest themselves. Now, protest is obviously a very costly and dangerous activity. I mean, you potentially lose your life, especially if you're protesting against an authoritarian regime. So there's a strong incentive to free ride there, right? So why take the danger yourself if you can let some other poor schmuck go out in the streets and protest, right, and take those costs themselves so that you don't have to put your own sort of life in danger and you still get the benefits of regime change. And so you have a strong incentive to free ride. And so if everybody has that same incentive to free ride, we can imagine that we're not going to see much protest. And so the sort of Mansur Olson is really sort of interested at the micro level, right, of explaining, and of course the huge amount of literature that this collective action problem sort of gave rise to is sort of trying to understand, how it is that we overcome that free rider problem at the local level. And I'm applying the same perspective here, right? So that, if we get religious competition, that gives the religious elite an incentive to maybe want to mobilize the laity or to at least allow the laity to use the religious institution politically. But we still have this sort of question, I think, about, okay, but how do the laity, how do the individuals who aren't religious elites, how do they themselves organize to overcome these collective action problems, and how do we actually develop the institutional capacity for collective action? And so I think that's the contribution that I'm sort of attempting to make with my project is trying to sort of think about this at a very micro level, you know, amongst the individuals who are in, who are taking on the costs and the dangers of political activism themselves. And so, you know, the explanation that I come up with that is, you know, I draw very extensively from, as I mentioned, Carolyn Warner sort of looked at, you know, the implications of religious hierarchy and how that affects political outcomes. And then, you know, Eleanor Ostrom very helpfully points to decentralized state networks and helping to overcome collective action problems at a local level in a very fine-grained sort of micro sort of way. And so sort of taking those insights, what I suggest is that where we have decentralized religious organizations, communities are subsequently capable of better collective action outcomes. And specifically what I'm looking at is political participation. So that, that essentially religious decentralization leads to heightened capacities for political participation.
All right. Decentralization. We love that here at Research on Religion.
That's the
big variable there that we're looking at, decentralization. So good theory. Actually, great theory. I kind of read this in one of your comparative politics articles and a big fan of your thesis and how it advances the literature. How do you prove it?
Yeah, so that's, you know, that's a great question. That was something that I definitely racked my brain about for a long time. And so I take a first of all, I would say we can't prove the theory. We can only sort of provide support for the theory, right? And so, you know, the task is to try to marshal evidence that could potentially falsify the theory, right? At best, the evidence that I sort of draw together can provide support for the theory. And so I take a sort of a two-pronged approach to that. So I do it both quantitatively and qualitatively. So I draw together this statistical data set, which is the basis for the comparative politics article that you mentioned. And essentially the goal of that statistical analysis is to basically test several theories that might explain how political participation in Mexico generally, right? So in my statistical analysis, I'm not just looking at southern Mexico, I'm looking at Mexico as a country. And so I do that with statistical data from what I've just come to call the ENCUP data set. That's the ENCUP data set, which is a Spanish acronym for basically the National Survey for Civic Culture and Citizen Practices. I think that's sort of how that sort of breaks down in English. And it's a handy data set because it looks at the perceptions, the knowledge, the attitudes, and behavior of Mexican voters in a nationally representative survey. So it's very handy, and basically the survey asks Mexicans a variety of potential types of political activities that they might be engaged in, and that's essentially what I use as the dependent variable in my statistical analysis. And so then I also, as I mentioned, I'm interested in sort of testing several theories that might potentially account for that, and particularly I'm interested in theories about how religious institutions in particular might account for that. And so I provide a variety of measures. I provide a measure that examines the impact of ideology, and here I have to give you and Rendering Under Caesar a lot of credit again, because the variable that I use for ideology, I borrow almost directly from the variable that you had used for ideology in that particular book. And so I sort of modify it slightly to fit better with the specific Mexican context, right? But that was certainly where that variable came from. And as far as, you know, so what I really sort of had to come up with was a defensible measure for decentralization, right? And so in my statistical data set, I used the number of permanent deacons in each diocese. I was looking to the extent that the Catholic Church in Mexico provides basically systematized statistical measures across its diocese across the country. Now, there's something like 90 dioceses in Mexico. And, you know, there's this sort of common misconception that the Catholic Church is this uniformly centralized institution, right, that bishops are, you know, that individual priests, right, are somehow directly answering to the Vatican about what it is that they're up to. And that's not actually the case at all in Mexico and really worldwide, right? I mean, there's a great deal of variation in the way that individual dioceses are managed. And maybe I should be a little bit clear about what I mean by dioceses. Basically, dioceses are, we can almost think of them as being like the states of the Mexican Catholic Church, right? So there are 90 of these, and each diocese is managed by a bishop. And a bishop actually has a great deal of power and authority to run his diocese in the manner that he would like to. And so what we see then is a lot of variation across dioceses in how they are administered and governed by their individual bishops. And so there's a lot of variation there that you can take advantage of. And so the key measure that I use to examine decentralization is the number of permanent deacons in each one of those dioceses. Now, my rationale for that is that with the Second Vatican Council in the early 1960s, we get the development of permanent deacons, and this is sort of a concerted effort by the Catholic Church to provide laity with increased avenues for engagement. These permanent deacons are given important responsibilities that had previously been only given to clergy. So they're given the responsibility to give sacramental rites. They can do baptism, for example. They're given the authority to teach, and they provide these services to the people that had previously been given only to priests. Okay, and the other important thing to point out about this deacon measure is that it's not uniformly given across dioceses. There are many dioceses that have no permanent deacons whatsoever because the bishops are concerned, right, about that this is devolving control to the laity, and they're wary of that. And so it's only in certain dioceses, right, that we see bishops devolve control to the local laity. So deacons are the measure that I use for that. Those are the key measures that I'm looking at.
A creative measure, by the way, too. I think that's institutional change. You can see the increase of the deaconate over time, and it's become
right.
increasingly important in the past 30, 40 years or so. Yeah.
That's right.
Good. Okay. And what do you find?
So what I find is in the statistical analysis that the deacon measure is, so I tested it in a variety of different ways. I run sort of every imaginable permutation on it that you could come up with. And it is consistently and positively linked to individual political participation. So individuals residing within dioceses that have a greater number of deacons have higher odds of either engaging in protest activity or associational activity. And I demonstrate that across a variety of statistical models. So I get a lot of support in the statistical portion of the paper for that particular proposition. The other thing I'm interested in doing with the statistical model is testing the influence of ideology and also religious competition. I'll be interested to talk about this with you too. And I find that, you know, ideology, the influence of ideology is sort of off and on. It's sort of present in some models, it's not present in others. And so I'm interested in this issue of, you know, the relationship between ideology and interest, right? And so the ideology measure basically is basically assessing the degree to which a particular diocese may have been predisposed to have a bishop who, you know, advocated for liberation theology. And so what I see is that when I interact the decentralization variable with this ideological variable, that they both mutually reinforce each other, right? So that ideology on its own may or may not be a prompter of political activism, but when it's interacted with decentralization, right, we see a reinforcing effect that the two have on each other. And so sort of the conclusion that I draw from that is that, you know, ideology creates an important demand factor for engagement, right? When you have political theology, we have a theology that advocates for individuals to agitate their governments and you know, try to take on the issue of social justice. That creates an important demand factor for political change, but you have to have the institutional capacity to engage in collective action. And that comes from, you know, I argue, from decentralization. And it's not until you have that institutional capacity that latent demand that's created by ideology can find expression. So I think that's one of the sort of the major takeaways from what I find in the model. As far as religious competition, that sort of is supported by several of the models, and it sort of doesn't find support in some of the models. I know you're going to have a couple of things you're going to want to ask about that, but why don't we go ahead and start with that, because I know
okay.
you don't want to.
That, actually, that, just to back up a moment, your idea that ideas need to have some kind of institutional capacity to make them realize that it kind of goes back to the old detective thing. You have to have means and motives. So motives in and of themselves don't commit an event, but rather you need the means to do that as well. So I think what you're finding is to me perfectly obvious. And I think it adds to the folks who say, well, it's just ideas. If you have ideas, they naturally translate into activity, but no, you need to have the means. Yeah, the religious competition one, And you had several models where that came up. Now, the data set that you had was time frame what?
Looking at 2003 and 2005. 2003 through 2005.
Yeah. So for me, you know, when I was reading your paper and I said, uh-oh, yeah, religious competition's coming there. Yay, win for me. And then you had a few models that didn't. I started thinking about this. I go, well, you know, what if it's the case that religious competition motivates some of the initial change? In fact, I think in my earlier work, I called it an alarm clock thesis. This is what wakes up the Catholic Church. And so you're going to see the effects much deeper in history. And so what you might be picking up here in the early 2000s is the residual impact of that. But once, I mean, and there is diffusion. I credit John Owen for really emphasizing this point with me, that there is diffusion of ideas that can travel through an institution saying, hey, down here, we tried these things and that worked really well. And other people might say, yeah, we're going to try that too, whether or not there's competition there. So what do you think about that read of the situation?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think for one thing, I haven't tried the diffusion. And so that would be an interesting thing to test in the statistical model, the potential diffusion of, you know, not just states that experience Protestant competition, but maybe states that are, you know, near those states, right, and see what kind of impact. And that would be something interesting to look at in a statistical model, which is something I can definitely do for the book. I think that you're certainly correct to point out that Protestant competition might have prompted decentralization. And this is a really important point actually to make, because it could be, because it really, if it's just, if religious decentralization is just a simple byproduct of competition, then decentralization is not the important explanatory factor here. It's really its competition, right? And I think you could make a similar point with ideology, in the sense that you know, what if decentralization really is just a byproduct of liberation theology, right? That you have liberation theology that wants more engagement by the lady, and so okay, this institutional stuff is nice, but really what it is the ideology that's driving it, right? And so it's important to address that. And so one of the things that I've tried to do that in multiple ways. Sort of one thing that I've done is I've actually run a statistical analysis using decentralization as the DV, right? So looking at the number of permanent deacons as my dependent variable. And sort of on the other side, as far as looking at sort of independent variables, there are a variety of things that I sort of include. I include the ideology measure, I include the religious competition, sort of also importantly, I also look at sort of institutional need. And so what this is there are a lot of arguments that suggest that in Latin America, there just simply aren't enough priests to effectively administer to the population, right? And what I find is that depending on how I run those models, to some extent, sort of all those are somewhat explanatory of why it is that we get decentralization, right? But what the issue would be, though, is that every time that we get, let me rewind just a little bit. What I find as being the single most important factor that explains why we get decentralization seems to be this sort of organizational need, right? It's just the fact that the Catholic Church is just not capable of administering to its people, right, its parishioners, with the priests that it has on hand, and so it has to do these permanent deacons, right, because that's the only way it can effectively evangelize. So that's an important aspect. So what I argue is that decentralization comes about because there's no purely exogenous factor, right? I mean, there's nothing in social science that's a purely exogenous factor. And so decentralization comes up about as a variety of, there are a variety of reasons why it happens. It comes about, I think, first and foremost, by, you know, the need that the Catholic Church has for it is an important explanatory factor, but it also comes about as a result of just the ideological managerial inclinations of individual bishops, right? And to the extent that they're either welcoming or not welcoming of these types of changes. It comes about, Protestant competition can prompt decentralization as a response to try to combat Protestantism, but let me return to that in just a minute. And ideology potentially can prompt decentralization at all. Also, but there's two really important caveats to think about when it comes to the religious competition and the ideology. And that's that when you have religious competition, decentralization is not necessarily the only avenue that Catholic bishops and priests have for trying to combat Protestantism. This is something that Guillermo Trejo points to in his 2009 APSR article, that if you look at Yucatan, actually, is a case that he looks at, and that while in Chiapas, Protestant competition may have prompted some form of institutional decentralization in order to combat with Protestants. That was where what Trejo argues is that in Chiapas, this was because you had mainline Protestant organizations that were offering material rewards for becoming Protestant, right? So the Catholic Church knew it couldn't compete with Protestants on those grounds, so it had to sort of create the institutional capacity at a local level so that these individuals could advocate for those material rewards directly from the state. Whereas in Yucatan, what Trejo argues is that what the Catholic Church was facing was more of these sort of evangelical Pentecostal type of denominations. And so they were emphasizing spiritual rewards as opposed to material rewards. So because of the nature of the Protestant competition that they faced, the Catholic Church, the Catholic clergy weren't, they weren't compelled to decentralize as an organizational principle to try to combat Protestantism. Instead, what Trejo says is they pursued charismatic Catholicism, right, as a way to try to combat the influence of Protestants. And so I think the important thing to keep in mind is that Protestant competition doesn't necessarily prompt decentralization as an organizational response, right? There's a lot of variance within that, and I think that might be one of the things that the way I see this is that religious competition is important because it makes the religious institution more predisposed to lend the organization its organizational resources for collective action. But it's not. But we still have to solve the local level collective action problems, and it's only with sort of a particular type of institutional form, right, that happens. I don't know if that makes that placates you at all, or
yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. I mean, it's the uh-huh. What substitutes you have becomes rather important, right? Because decentralizing is a relatively expensive institutional reform as compared to maybe charismatic Catholicism, or as I've argued in the past, one of the responses was that you get rid of the Protestants, you kick them out. That's the easiest and most cost effective. Right. But if that's not available, then you go to these other means. Actually, I think your idea that decentralization is the really working horse in this model here. I think it's absolutely accurate for the collective action problem. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. I will say too that sort of a similar argument can be made about ideology. Just to quickly return to that too, because I brought it up. And yeah, the other argument could be that liberation theology, encourages this form of decentralization, and that could be true as an ideological preset. But in reality, Daniel Levine has done extensive research on Christian-based communities across Latin America. And one of the conclusions that he comes from that is that it is not at all uncommon for progressive Catholic clergy to try to implement liberation theology in very authoritarian ways, right? In ways that sort of, there's a bishop in Chihuahua in the 1970s who was a liberation theologian, and he essentially, the story, this is told by Vikram Chan, and looking at sort of basically the development of the PAN in Mexico, is the story that he tells is that you had this very progressive bishop in Chihuahua in the northern part of Mexico who wanted basically to force liberation theology on his parishioners, right? That this was an ideological goal of his, but the parishioners themselves didn't really want it, right? It wasn't really pertinent to their lives. The idea of social justice wasn't something that they were particularly interested in. And so he hadn't devolved, and we can talk a little bit more about what I mean by decentralization, but decentralization is a very broad term, right? And so and for the sake of sort of analytical clarity, I really define decentralization as, where you have monitoring, sanctioning, and decision making at a local level. And we can talk a little bit more about that if you want to, but decision making, monitoring, and sanctioning hadn't been devolved to a local level. So you had him trying to push, the sort of liberation theology ideas onto this population that didn't really they didn't really have a voice in sort of saying whether or not they wanted it, right? And so one of the conclusions that Levine comes to is that it's not uncommon to see this across Latin America, right? That you have progressive priests and progressive bishops who are trying to sort of push liberation theology, but they're not devolving. And even if the people want it, right, it's not accompanied by these devolved institutions, and so it doesn't really take up, right? It sort of fails as an experiment for that reason.
Yeah. So again, decentralized institutional forms are the workhorse here, and I think that's pretty cool. So talk a little bit about what you mean by decentralization, and how I would like you to do this is to bring in some of the qualitative work. So in your comparative politics article that we're working from here, is mostly a quantitative piece, but in your book, you're going to expand this into qualitative directions, which you do in your dissertation and have done a lot of field work down there. So explain what it means in reality to be decentralized, and how did this play out with what you saw there on the ground?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, and I just want to sort of say really quickly too that I'm a big proponent of mixed methods research. So with the statistical model that I've sort of presented here, we have some confidence, right, that there's some sort of general relationship between, you know, decentralization and political activism, right, that they're related in some general way across Mexico. But the nice thing that I see about qualitative sort of methods of research is that, you know, they statistical analysis can have, I think, two main weaknesses. And the first is whether or not the measures that we're using are actually valid, right? I mean, whether or not they're actually sort of capturing the type of phenomenon that we think that we're capturing with them. And the other issue is okay, so we've demonstrated this sort of relationship between decentralization and political activism, but how is that elicited, right? I mean, how does it happen? How do we get from X to Y? And that's where I think qualitative methods have a real comparative methodological advantage, because, you know, it gives us more confidence that the measures that we're using in a statistical analysis are actually, you know, accurate measures, and it gives us an opportunity to sort of work us from how we get to decentralization to political activism. And so what I argue, I guess the first sort of aspect of this is to flesh out sort of the causal mechanisms of the theory, and which is what I do through the qualitative research, is sort of flesh these out. And so what I suggest is that where you get decentralization, what you have is basically local level monitoring, sanctioning, and decision making. And what I mean by that is, when you have local level monitoring, that means that the individual laity themselves, right, not the clergy, but the people who don't necessarily minister, the people who haven't necessarily been traditionally given decision-making functions of the religious organization, this is where they are now responsible for making sure that other people in the religious organization are sort of adhering to their responsibilities, right, that they're not defecting against other members of the religious institution. And I'm going to use a little bit of prisoner's dilemma type of language here. And so when I say defecting, that just means that you're behaving opportunistically, right? That somebody else is sort of paying a cost to accomplish something in a religious organization, and you free ride off of that cost, right? That's sort of defecting. So monitoring the responsibility of making sure that other people aren't defecting is given on individuals in the community themselves. Sanctioning responsibilities are given to the individuals in the communities themselves. So again, this means that it's not the priests who are making sanctioning responsibilities. So what this means is that if somebody's caught defecting, if somebody's caught engaging in opportunistic behavior, it's not the priest who's going, it's not a member of the hierarchy or the clergy that's going to punish that individual. It's the community itself is going to decide how to punish that individual, and it's going to be responsible for punishing that individual. And then decision-making is basically communities get to make their own decisions over a wide variety of aspects about what it is that the religious institution is going to do. And that could range from things like what the themes for discussion are on Sundays. That can range from what types of club goods the religious organization itself is going to produce, right? So that means that at a local level, it's the community that makes those decisions. It's not the religious clergy. And so decentralization is evolved monitoring, sanctioning, decision-making authority. And so qualitatively, I examine this in the cases of Chiapas and Yucatan. And so what I find in Chiapas, and so I guess let me walk through the causal mechanisms then. So that once you have that decentralization, what happens is that individuals become more willing to interact with each other within a particular community, right? And this is because local level monitoring is a little bit more efficient, right? So individuals, they know that if they're going to defect, it's more likely that their defection is going to be caught by one of their community members, as opposed to if it was just the priest who was responsible for that. He can't monitor everybody. A centralized institution, it's more costly for a centralized institution to monitor the activities of what a particular community is doing, as opposed to if you give that responsibility to the members themselves, right, collectively, right, everybody can sort of keep track of what everybody's doing. And so individuals have a little bit more confidence, right, that if somebody is defecting, if somebody is sort of taking advantage of others, that they're going to be caught for doing that, right? So those individuals are isolated, right? They're not given, sanctioning occurs through, those individuals don't receive the religious club goods. So whatever goods and services, and I'll sort of, this is all abstract right now, and when I get into what I actually did in the qualitative comparison, I think this will be a little bit less abstract. But they don't receive the goods and benefits that are provided by the religious organization. And so that's what sanctioning is, right? You don't get those goods and services. And so what happens is that the people who are left are increasingly confident, right, that if they contribute to the group, that contribution is going to be reciprocated. People aren't going to take advantage of that. And so you get this core group of individuals who are increasingly willing to contribute to the religious organization. And that means that the religious organization now is providing increasingly valuable club goods to its members. This draws more members in, right, because they want to take advantage of the goods and services that are being produced by the religious community. And in the process of that, right, you get this religious organization that's producing more goods and services for its members. You're drawing an increasing membership, and what happens is organically you develop the organizational base that can then be applied to political activism. Okay, so that's sort of the general sort of mechanism of how I sort of see that functioning.
So tell us how this plays out in, like, I mean, you were down there in Chiapas, you were down there in Yucatan. Right. You'll see the decentralization making a difference in Chiapas. Obviously, that's where it plays out more. So how does, I mean, did you see evidence of, you know, community saying, oh, yeah, you know, the deacon prompted us to do this, that, and that thing?
Yeah, so the way I look at this, so in Yucatan, or I'm sorry, in Chiapas, I think the important thing to sort of point out first in Chiapas is that decentralization doesn't really start until about the 1960s. That's when you get the arrival of Bishop Samuel Ruiz into, you know, he's inspired by liberation theology. He's also inspired by encroaching Protestant competition in Chiapas. He's inspired by you know, his own managerial approach to want to devolve the responsibilities to the local level, and so we get the devolution of several types of important responsibilities to the local level. The first is that local indigenous communities are given the responsibility to teach the Bible in the way that they would like to. They're given the opportunity to develop their own themes for discussion, and as a result of that, they begin to focus on their own socioeconomic problems, right, as themes for discussion in these sort of small-level local Bible groups that now these individuals have sort of the responsibility for conducting. As far as monitoring and sanctioning goes, I think the important thing to preface with this is that there are a variety of goods and services that are provided by religious institutions to their members. These are spiritual goods, you know, that religious organizations provide existential assurance to their members. They provide sort of a collective worship experience that's important to the members, but they also provide important material goods for individuals, and particularly in places like Mexico, where the state doesn't necessarily have the capacity to provide generous welfare provisions for its members, particularly in places like Chiapas. You know, religious organizations have a very important function in providing goods and services to their members. And so one of the things that we see is that a real goal for the Catholic Church in Chiapas is to create some type of organizational self-capacity, right, so that individual communities can provide goods and services to themselves. And we see this in Chiapas primarily through economic cooperatives. So we get a variety of different types of economic cooperatives. Just to use an example, maybe to help frame the discussion, one type of cooperative might be a coffee cooperative, right? These are formed directly by the Catholic Church, and the managerial responsibilities, the way this would sort of function would be that you might have a priest that would come into a particular community or a Jesuit priest of some kind who comes in, instructs the community about basically how to organize one of these things, right, and then completely devolves managerial responsibilities for the cooperative to the community itself, right? And this is all formally through the Catholic Church. And so very, very importantly, what we get is there are monitoring responsibilities involved with this, right? So the community monitors the productive contributions of members to the coffee cooperative. So it does this basically by measuring how much each individual is providing to the cooperative. How many beans did you produce, right? And you can sort of measure the productive contribution of members, and the community itself is responsible for that. And the community itself then decides what the sanction is. I should also say there's a huge level of local variation as to how they might monitor the productive contributions of members. It might be by measuring the direct contributions of individuals. You might embed an older worker in a community with a younger worker to make sure that the younger worker is working and fulfilling his responsibilities, his or her responsibilities as a cooperative, right? But they're all sort of concerned in some way of measuring the productive output of their members. And we see sanctioning, right? If somebody is not living up to their responsibilities, these cooperatives provide a variety of excludable club goods. And so if you're not pulling your weight, I think one of the main ways that we might see this is that individuals who produce a larger number of coffee beans, for example, receive a larger percentage of the profit that is produced by the coffee cooperative, right? So that's inherently exclusionary, right? The more you produce, the greater your share of the profit is going to be. Individuals, you know, the cooperative office will provide a variety of health benefits. They provide a variety of fair trade incentives, right? And if you're not paying your dues, if you're not producing, if you're not, you know, hitting your quota of what you're supposed to be producing for the cooperative, you are excluded from those goods and services. And so what happens is, and this is very fitful, right? I don't want to create the impression that this was sort of like a, this is a very smooth operation, right? That once the Catholic Church had sort of devolved these responsibilities and created these cooperatives that individuals were had the capacity to monitor and sanction each other, that it just automatically translated into the sort of organizational network that created political activism. There was a lot of resistance at first, right, because the reciprocity wasn't in place in the communities. And it wasn't until you get these sort of fitful starts where some of these cooperatives become, you know, incrementally become more and more successful at producing profits for their members, that draws in more and more individuals who are interested in cooperating and participating in the cooperative, in the club goods that are being produced by these cooperatives that are directly created by the Catholic Church. And so it's in that process, right, that this sort of fitful process that these cooperatives start to become increasingly productive. They draw in, they increasingly entice new members, right? And then you create this organizational capacity, and some of these cooperatives become huge regional economic engines for their communities. I mean, they become enormous to some extent, especially when we think about sort of the size of economic production in Chiapas. And so what did they start doing? They start networking with each other. They start networking across communities, across the region, right? And they form organically an organizational base. And that organizational base then sort of coalesces and it forms political interest groups, right? And these political interest groups then lead marches and they lead protest movements. And these cooperatives also become the base for what is eventually going to become the Zapatista guerrilla group, right, that engages in an armed insurrection against the Mexican government. So that's sort of the basis of the qualitative evidence that I marshal. If we look at Yucatan, we don't get any of these devolved responsibilities. What we don't get, you know, this is sort of the dog that doesn't bark, right? But, you know, we don't get any of these devolved responsibilities. We don't get the creation of an organizational base, and the Catholic Church is completely ineffective, is just not a non-factor in sort of being the basis for any kind of political activism.
Yeah, I think at the micro level here, too, what's really interesting is that the opportunity to engage in some organizational activities teaches you how to do it. Right. If you're doing something in your local church and then the local cooperative, well, now you know how to organize people. You know how to monitor people and to enforce these kind of things. Where you were talking earlier about the bishop in Chihuahua that says, okay, everybody, now here's some liberation theology. Let's do this. Everybody probably stood around and go, well, we don't know how to do that.
Right.
And it kind of fits in with the general literature out there that says people in churches in very actively engaged parishes or congregations learn a lot of these basic civic engagement skills and then take them out to other places, be it, you know, soccer clubs or the Chamber of Commerce or something, or the Zapatista guerrilla army. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that's sort of the purpose of the qualitative framework, right? Is to flesh out, you know, sort of make that a little bit less abstract and sort of, you know, flesh out the causal mechanisms of how that relationship functions.
Let me finish up with this question that I always do with all my guests here, and that the research process, especially when you're doing your dissertation and making into your first book, it's this process that you're with for a long time. I don't think people realize that, you know, you're with this for 10 years or so, and it just kind of sticks with you. And that gives you the opportunity to learn a lot, to change your mind about things, to be surprised by things that you didn't expect. Was there anything like that along the way? Was there something that you said, whoa, I didn't expect that, or wow, I really learned something from that?
Yeah, I would say both through sort of this process and through some of the work I've done on this Science of Generosity project that I'm working on with Kellen Warner and Ramazan Quinch and Adam Cohen, I went into this really sort of hardcore religious economy school sort of thinking to myself, well, this is all about interest. I mean, that was really the story I was telling myself is that, you know, interests are, I fully expect that the interest-based story is going to be the story here that's the dominant story. And then as I sort of really got into it, you know, both through the evidence of the statistical analysis, which we've talked about, you know, the ideologies are popping up as being sort of a relevant variable, But also, you know, you just, it's just impossible to escape the conclusion when you sit down and talk to these people that they're motivated by their ideology, right? I mean, that they are really drawing, you know, some of them are drawing true inspiration, right, from some of the precepts of liberation theology about what it is that their mission is. And I think that as social scientists, there's a temptation to sort of just dismiss that as being, well, you know, they're just sort of convincing themselves that they have this ideological motivation for what really is sort of, you know, motivating their interests. But, you know, as I've thought about it, and this is where, you know, I'm also trying to, you talk about how a project evolves, right, and trying to fit my project a little bit more into sort of the existing sort of, I guess what we could describe as maybe a more sociological approach to collective action, which sort of emphasizes, you know, political opportunity structures, resource mobilization, and ideology and the importance of ideological framing, right? And I think, you know, economists have a way of thinking about ideological framing too, and I think that this is to think about the coordinating function of ideology, right? And the sense that, you know, I think that the important role that ideology serves, you know, among others, is that it just simply coordinates the interests and activities of actors, right? It gives them something to, because otherwise we can imagine, so even in Chavez, right, one of the things I argue in the dissertation is that, so we get sort of decentralization, we get communities who have the local capacity, and then political activism goes in 10,000 different directions, right? Because it's decentralized, right? You have decentralized local actors who are sort of making their decisions about what it is that they want to do. And if you don't have, even in Chavez, where you had this sort of overarching liberation theology, right, which was, you know, was very helpful in coordinating the activities and expectations of the actors, right, you still had this temptation for a lot of communities to say, well, we don't really like what they're doing, we're going to do something else, right? And so what ideology does, which is very, very important, is that it provides some kind of cohesive framework so that actors can set their expectations about what it is that they want to do. And given the fact that you can go in 10,000 directions, you can imagine that if you have, you know, these very, very solidary communities, right, and they're all going in their own completely different directions and pursuing their own completely disparate interests, you're never going to form a regional political movement. But if you have a common ideology that coordinates their activities and coordinates their interests, you know, suddenly, right, that can become directed and become a regional power, right? It could be something that is regionally important. And that was something that I think, that was one of the big things that I wasn't sort of, when I started this, I wasn't expecting my thinking to go that way, right? But I've really seen the importance of that, and it's something that I'm working to really, I think, sort of effectively theorize in the book, right? Which I guess I'm sort of still on my way to that, right? But the importance of ideology as a coordinating device, right, is something that I think is very important.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that, and some of the thinking about how economists are bringing back norms into their equations, I think you're right there on the cusp of that, in that your research agenda will make a lot of contributions to that. So we'll be expecting that book coming out shortly, we hope. I don't know. It takes a while to get those things copy edited, but we will make sure that everybody knows about it when it does come out. And my guest today has been Christopher Hale. Chris, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony, very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.